and in the development of civilization. Eurasia would therefore integrate its future members with Russia without any of the troubling burdens associated with the EU. No dictator would have to step down, no free elections would have to be held, no laws would have to be upheld. Eurasia was a spoiler system designed to prevent states from joining the EU and prevent their societies from thinking that this was possible. In the long run, Putin explained, Eurasia would overwhelm the EU in a larger Union of Europe, a space between the Atlantic and the Pacific, from Lisbon to Vladivostok. Not to join Eurasia, Putin said, would be to promote separatism in the broadest sense of the word. As a presidential candidate in 2011 and 2012, Putin promised the release of Russia from general standards and the extension of Russian particularities to others. If Russia could be portrayed as a pristine source of civilizational values that others had lost, then the question of reforming Russian kleptocracy would become irrelevant. As a beacon for others, Russia should be celebrated but not altered. Putin was matching his words with his deeds, since he had made European integration unthinkable for his people. The way that Putin assumed the office of president made his Eurasian turn irreversible. The abandonment of democratic procedures in 2011 and 2012 mocked a basic criterion of EU membership. To clear protesters from the street by violence and then portray them as agents of Europe was to define the EU as an enemy. Russia had no plausible principle of succession, and the future of the Russian state was uncertain, but none of this could be said. Putin could control the state, but not reform it. So foreign policy had to take the place of domestic policy, and diplomacy had to be about culture rather than security. In effect, this meant exporting Russian chaos while speaking of Russian order, spreading disintegration in the name of integration. Once inaugurated as president in May 2012, Putin presented Eurasia as an instrument to dissolve the EU in order to simplify the world order so that empires could compete for territory. The black hole at the center of his system could not be filled, but it could draw in neighbors. At his inauguration, Putin proposed that Russia become a leader and a center of gravity for the whole of Eurasia. Addressing Parliament that December, he spoke of a coming catastrophe that would commence a new era of colonial resource wars. At such a moment, it would be frivolous to propose reform or to imagine progress. During this permanent emergency, Putin proclaimed, Russia would rely on its native genius within Great Russian Spaces. The reference to Great Spaces, a concept from the Nazi legal thinker Carl Schmitt, was not even the most striking moment of the address. Using the odd word passionarity, Putin evoked a special Russian ability to thrive amidst global chaos. Such passionarity would determine, according to Putin, who will take the lead and who will remain outsiders and inevitably lose their independence. The strange term was the invention of one Russian thinker, Lev Gumilov. Unlike Ilin, who had to be rediscovered, Gumilov was a Soviet citizen. His signature term passionarity was recognizable to Russians, even if unnoticed elsewhere. As Russians knew, Gumilov was the modern exemplar of Eurasian thought. Long before Putin announced his Eurasian policy, Eurasian thought had represented a specific Russian proposal to dominate and transform Europe. This important intellectual tendency had arisen in the 1920s as a response to the earlier Russian disagreement between Slavophiles and Westernizers. The Westernizers of the 19th century believed that history was unitary and that the path to progress was singular. For them, Russia's problem was backwardness, and so reform or revolution was needed to push Russia to a modern European future. The Slavophiles believed that progress was illusory and that Russia was endowed with a particular genius. Orthodox Christianity and popular mysticism, they maintained, expressed the depth of spirit unknown in the West. The Slavophiles imagined that Russian history had begun with the Christian conversion in Kiev 1,000 years before. Ilin began as a Westernizer and ended as a Slavophile, a trajectory that was very common. The first Eurasianists were exiled Russian scholars of the 1920s, contemporaries of Ilin, who rejected both the Slavophile and the Westernizer attitudes. They agreed with the Slavophiles that the West was decadent, but denied the Slavophile myth of Christian continuity with ancient Kiev. The Eurasianists saw no meaningful connection between the ancient Rus of Volodymyr Valdemar and modern Russia. They focused instead on the Mongols, who had easily defeated the remnants of Rus in the early 1240s. In their vision, the happy conventions of Mongol rule allowed for the foundation of a new city, Moscow, in an environment safe from European corruptions, such as the classical heritage of Greece and Rome, the Renaissance, the Reformation, and the Enlightenment. Modern Russia's destiny was to turn Europe into Mongolia. The Eurasianists of the 1920s soon scattered, and some of them renounced their earlier views. They had one gifted acolyte within the Soviet Union, Lev Gumilov, 1912 to 1992. Gumilov was born to an extraordinary family and lived one of the most tragically and garishly Soviet lives imaginable. Lev's parents were the poets Nikolai Gumilov and Anna Akhmatova. When Lev was 9 years old, his father was executed by the Cheka. His mother then wrote one of the most famous poems in modern Russia, which included the verse, it loves droplets of blood, the Russian land. With such parents, Lev had difficulty submerging himself into his university studies in the 1930s. He was observed closely by the secret police and denounced by his colleagues. In 1938, during the Great Terror, he was sentenced to 5 years in the Gulag to a camp at Norilsk. This inspired his mother's famous requiem, in which Anna referred to Lev as, "My son, my horror." In 1949, Gumilov was once again sentenced to the Gulag, this time to 10 years near Karaganda. After Stalin's death in 1953, he was released, but the years in the Gulag left their mark. Gumilov saw the inspirational possibilities in repression and believed that the basic biological truths of life were revealed in extreme settings. Writing as an academic in the Soviet Union of the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, Gumilov revived the Eurasian tradition. He agreed with his teachers that Mongolia was the source of Russian character and its shelter from Western decadence. Like the emigre scholars of the 1920s, he portrayed Eurasia as a proud heartland that extended from the Pacific Ocean to a meaningless and sick European peninsula at the western extreme. Whereas the original Eurasians had been serious scholars with disciplinary training in the universities of the Russian Empire, Gumilov was a typical Soviet autodidact, an enthusiastic amateur in several fields. To define the boundary between Eurasia and Europe, for example, he relied upon climate. He used the average January temperature to draw a line that ran through Germany. On one side was Eurasia, and on the other, Europe. It just so happened that, when Gumilov made this argument, East Germany was under Soviet domination and West Germany was not. Gumilov's contribution to Eurasianism was his theory of ethnogenesis, an explanation of how nations arise. It began from a specific understanding of astrophysics and human biology. Gumilov maintained that human sociability was generated by cosmic rays. Some human organisms were more capable than others of absorbing space energy and retransmitting it to others. These special leaders, in possession of the passionarity Putin mentioned in his 2012 speech, were the founders of ethnic groups. According to Gumilov, the genesis of each nation could therefore be traced to a burst of cosmic energy, which began a cycle that lasted for more than 1,000 years. The cosmic rays that enlivened Western nations had been emitted in the distant past, and so the West was dead. The Russian nation arose from cosmic emissions on September 13, 1380, and was therefore young and vibrant. Gumilov also added a specific form of anti-Semitism to the Eurasian tradition, one that enabled Russians to blame their own failings on the Jews and the West at the same time. The relevant concept was that of the chimera, or false nation. Healthy nations such as the Russian, warned Gumilov, must beware chimerical groups that draw life not from cosmic rays, but from other groups. He meant the Jews. For Gumilov, the history of Rus did not show that Russia was ancient, but it did show that Jews were an eternal threat. Gumilov claimed that in medieval Rus, it was the Jews who had traded slaves, establishing themselves as a military commercial octopus. These Jews, according to Gumilov, were agents of a permanently hostile Western civilization that sought to weaken and defame Rus. He also claimed that Rus had to pay tribute to Jews in blood. Gumilov therefore advanced three basic elements of modern anti-Semitism: the Jew as the soulless traitor, the Jew as the drinker of Christian blood, and the Jew as the agent of an alien civilization. Despite his years in the Gulag, Gumilov came to identify himself with the Soviet Union as his Russian homeland. He made friends and taught students, and his influence even after his death in 1992 was considerable. The economist Sergei Glazyov, who advised Yeltsin and Putin, referred to Gumilev and used his concepts. Glazyov spoke of an economic union with state planning based on the philosophy of Eurasianism. Gumilev was friendly with the philosopher Yuri Borodai and his son Alexander. The younger Borodai dreamed of the armed passionary, people who would be catalyzers of powerful movements that would liberate the entire territory of Eurasia. As president, Vladimir Putin would not only cite Gumilev on the Eurasian project, but he would appoint Sergei Glazyov his advisor on Eurasia. Not long after, Alexander Borodai would take an important part in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. To speak of Eurasia in the Russia of the 2010s was to refer to two distinct currents of thought that overlapped at two points, the corruption of the West and the evil of the Jews. The Eurasianism of the 2010s was a rough mixture of a Russian tradition developed by Gumilev with Nazi ideas mediated by the younger Russian fascist Alexander Dugin, born 1962. Dugin was not a follower of the original Eurasianists nor a student of Gumilev. He simply used the terms Eurasia and Eurasianism to make Nazi ideas sound more Russian. Dugin, born half a century after Gumilev, was an anti-establishment kid of the Soviet 1970s and 1980s, playing his guitar and singing about killing millions of people in ovens. His life's work was to bring fascism to Russia. As the Soviet Union came to an end, Dugin traveled to Western Europe to find intellectual allies. Even as Europe integrated, there were marginal thinkers of the far right who preserved Nazi ideas, celebrated national purity, and decried economic, political, and legal cooperation as part of some global conspiracy. These were Dugin's interlocutors. An early influence was Miguel Serrano, author of Hitler, The Last Avatar, who claimed that the Aryan race owed its superiority to its extraterrestrial origins. Dugin, like Gumilev, found Ilin's Russian redeemer by seeking beyond Earth. If the leader must arrive untainted by events, he must come from somewhere beyond history. Ilin resolved the issue by presenting a redeemer who emerged from fiction in a poof of erotic mysticism. The mature Gumilev and the young Dugin looked to the stars. In the early 1990s, Dugin became close to the French conspiracy theorist Jean Parvulescu, who spoke to him of the ancient conflict between people of the sea, Atlanticists, and people of the earth, Eurasianists. In Parvulescu's idea, the Americans and British yield to abstract Jewish ideas because their maritime economies separate them from the earthy truths of human experience. Alain de Benoist of the French neo-fascist movement known as the Nouvelle Droite explained to Dugin the centrality of the United States to such schemes as the representative abstract Jewish culture. These were updates of Nazi ideas, as Dugin well understood. At the time, Dugin was writing under the pen name Zivas, a reference to Wolfram Zivas, a German Nazi executed for war crimes in 1947, who had been known for collecting the bones of murdered Jews. Dugin's European contacts allowed him to bring Nazi concepts home to Russia. In 1993, Dugin and Eduard Limonov, who called Dugin the St. Cyril and Methodius of fascism, founded the National Bolshevik Party. Its members raised their fists while hailing death. In 1997, Dugin called for a fascism borderless and red. Dugin exhibited standard fascist views. Democracy was hollow, the middle class was evil, Russians must be ruled by a man of destiny, America was malevolent, Russia was innocent. Dugin shared with Ilin a debt to Carl Schmitt. It was Schmitt who had formulated a vision of world politics without laws and states, grounded instead in the subjective desires of cultural groups for ever more land. Schmitt dismissed the empty concept of state territory and regarded the nation as fundamentally an organism. In his view, the Eurasian landmass was a great space to be mastered by whoever could take it. Schmitt claimed that maritime powers such as Great Britain and the United States were bearers of abstract Jewish notions of law. He formulated the concept of international law by which the world would be divided into a few great spaces from which spatially alien powers should be excluded. He meant that the United States should have no influence in Europe. Dugin preserved these ideas while simply changing the entity that was supposedly threatened by Jews, America, and law, no longer Nazi Germany, but instead contemporary Russia. Dugin dismissed Ilin as an inferior philosopher who served nothing more than a technical function in the Putin regime. Nevertheless, much of Dugin's writing reads like a parody of Ilin. The West, claimed Dugin in a typical expostulation, is the place where Lucifer fell. It is the center for the global capitalist octopus. The West, Dugin continued, is the matrix of rotten cultural perversion and wickedness, deceit and cynicism, violence and hypocrisy. It was so decadent that it would collapse at any moment, and yet it was a constant threat. Democracy was not its renewal, but the sign of a coming cataclysm. Dugin regarded the re-election of Barack Obama as president of the United States in 2012 in these terms. Let him ruin this country. Let justice finally prevail so that this monstrous colossus on clay feet, this new Carthage, which spreads its abominable economic and political power across the entire world and tries to fight with all and against all, so that it quickly disappears. These characterizations of the West are axioms, not observations. The facts of the present are irrelevant, as are the facts of the past. For Dugin, as for Ilin, the past only matters as a reservoir of symbols, of what Dugin called archetypes. The past provided Dugin with what Russians called the spiritual resource, a source of images to be used to alter the present. Writing in the early 21st century, Dugin was confronted with the success of the European Union, a hyper-legal entity that rescued states after empire. Dugin never pronounced its name. When asked to comment upon the EU, Dugin asserted that it was doomed. Long before Putin began to speak of a Eurasia that must include Ukraine as an element of Russian civilization, Dugin defined the independent Ukrainian state as the barrier to Russia's Eurasian destiny. In 2005, Dugin founded a state-supported youth movement whose members urged the disintegration and Russification of Ukraine. In 2009, Dugin foresaw a battle for Crimea and eastern Ukraine. The existence of Ukraine, in Dugin's view, constituted an enormous danger for all of Eurasia. Concepts from the three interflowing currents of Russian fascism, Ilin's Christian totalitarianism, Gumilov's Eurasianism, and Dugin's Eurasian Nazism, appeared in Putin's discourse as he sought an exit from the dilemma he created for his country in 2012. Fascist ideas burst into the Russian public sphere during the Obama administration's attempt to reset relations with the Russian Federation. The dramatic change in Russia's orientation bore no relation to any new unfriendly action from outside. Western enmity was not a matter of what a Western actor was doing, but what the West was portrayed as being. In 2012, fascist thinkers were placed in the Russian mainstream by a Russian president who seemed to think that he needed them. Ilin had been granted as full a resuscitation as a state can give a philosopher. Gumilov was cited by Putin in his most important address. Dugin became a frequent guest on Russia's largest television channel. The Eurasian idea was a preoccupation of a new think tank, the Izborsk Club. Its members included Dugin, Glazyov, and Tikhon Shevkunov, Putin's favorite monk and his companion at Ilin's gravesite. Shevkunov was the author of the cyclical idea that Putin reincarnated Volodymyr Valdemar of Rus, and also the author of the best-selling book In Russia of 2012. The founder and moving spirit of the Izborsk Club was the fascist novelist Alexander Prokhanov, Putin's companion in that radio program of December 2011, where Putin had cited Ilin. Like Dugin, Prokhanov used the notion of Eurasia to mean the return of Soviet power in fascist form. Also like Dugin, he repeated the ideas of Carl Schmitt. If Prokhanov had a core belief, it was the endless struggle of the empty and abstract sea people against the hardy and righteous land people. Like Adolf Hitler, Prokhanov blamed world Jewry for inventing the ideas that enslaved his homeland. He also blamed them for the Holocaust. Like Dugin, Prokhanov openly embraced political fiction, seeking to create drastic images that would exude meaning before people had the chance to think for themselves. An example of his creative mind was his reaction to the election of Barack Obama as president of the United States. Discussing a meeting of Obama with Russians, Prokhanov moaned that it was as if they had all been given a black teat, and they all suck at it with lust and mammalian smacking. In the end, I was humiliated by this. Amidst the ceaseless ink flood of Prokhanov's publications, the most pertinent to Eurasia was an interview he gave in Kyiv, Ukraine, on August 31st, 2012, right before the opening of the Izborsk Club. That March, Ukraine and the European Union had initialed an association agreement, and the Ukrainian government had undertaken an action plan to prepare the country for the signing of the accord the following year. Baffled by Prokhanov's attitude towards Europe, his interview asked him questions that revealed basic Eurasian themes: the precedence of fiction over fact, the conviction that European success was a sign of evil, the belief in a global Jewish conspiracy, and the certainty of Ukraine's Russian fate. When asked about the high standard of living in the EU, Prokhanov responded, "Swim across the Dnipro River and find mushrooms growing great under the sun." A momentary vision of a primal Slavic experience was more important than a durable way of life created by decades of work for the benefit of hundreds of millions of people. Prokhanov's next move was to claim that factuality was hypocrisy. "Europe is vermin that has learned to call heinous and disgusting things beautiful. Whatever Europeans might seem to be doing or saying, you don't see their faces under the masks. In any event, Europe was dying. The white race is perishing, gay marriages, pederasts rule the cities, women can't find men. And Europe was killing Russia. We didn't get infected with AIDS, they deliberately infected us." The fundamental problem, said Prokhanov in this interview, was the Jews. "Antisemitism," he said, "is not a result of the fact that Jews have crooked noses or cannot correctly pronounce the letter R. It is a result of the fact that Jews took over the world and are using their power for evil." In a move that was typical of Russian fascists, Prokhanov deployed the symbolism of the Holocaust to describe world Jewry as a collective perpetrator and everyone else as the victims. "Jews united humanity in order to throw humanity into the furnace of the liberal order, which is now suffering a catastrophe. The only defense against the international Jewish conspiracy was a Russian redeemer. Eurasianism was Russia's messianic mission to redeem mankind. It has to encompass the entire world." This grand redemptive project, said Prokhanov, would begin when Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus merge. "When I speak of Russia," said Prokhanov, "I have in view people living in Ukraine and Belarus." Ukraine had before it a colossal messianic mission, because the destiny of Kiev was to bow before Moscow and thus commence the Russian conquest of the world. "If the first empire was established here," said Prokhanov, meaning Rus, 1,000 years before, "the future empire has already been proclaimed by Putin. It is the Eurasian Union, and Ukraine's contribution to this empire could be grandiose." "In the end," asked Prokhanov, "why be at the outskirts of London when you can be at the center of Eurasia?" Prokhanov was concerned that Ukraine's president, Viktor Yanukovych, might not be able to fulfill this assignment. Perhaps, he mused, the government of Ukraine would have to be changed. The Izborsk Club, the intellectual hub of the new Russian nationalism, was inaugurated a few days later, on September 8, 2012. Its manifesto began with the claim, familiar from Ilin, that factuality was a Western weapon against Russia. "The Russian state has once again been exposed to the deadly threat posed from liberal centers, a threat from within Russian society and from beyond its borders. The lethal ideological and informational machine that destroyed all the bases and values of the White Romanov Empire and then destroyed all the foundations of the Red Soviet Empire is everywhere at work. The fall of these empires transformed the great Eurasian space into a chaos of warring peoples, faiths, and cultures on fields of blood. This liberal machine was built with the help of anthropologists and historians, social scientists and specialists in chaos theory, economists and masters of information wars. It disintegrates the fundamental principles by which the unified Eurasian state is constructed. It suppresses the underlying codes of national consciousness that the nation needs to be victorious and to extend its existence in history. This battering machine pounds at the Orthodox Church, the spiritual basis of the nation. It prevents the construction of a national security apparatus, leaving Russia unarmed at a time of rising military conflict. It sows discord amidst the harmony of Russia's main religious confessions. It prevents the reconciliation of Russia's historical epochs. It prolongs the ruinous Russian time of troubles, demonizing the Russian leader and all institutions of authority. No reference was made in the manifesto to any specific European or American policy. The problem was not what Europeans or Americans did, but that the European Union and the United States existed. As Prokhanov had made clear already, the enmity of the West was to be taken as a given, even when Western actors pursued friendly policies to Russia. the manifesto's authors replaced history with eternity, the cyclical pattern of Western perfidy and Russian innocence. According to the manifesto, previous Eurasian empires had flourished as no empires had before, and then crashed into a black hole from which, as it seemed, there was no return. But the state was again reborn, in another form, with another historical center, and again rose and flourished before declining and disappearing. This circularity, the death of the state and his triumph over death, confer upon Russian history a resurrectionary character in which Russian civilization inevitably rises from the dead. The first empire was that of Kiev Novgorod. The second was Muscovy. The third empire was that of the Romanov dynasty. The fourth empire was the Soviet Union. Today's Russian state, despite the loss of great territories, still carries the mark of empire. The geopolitics of the Eurasian continent once again forcefully gathers spaces that had been lost. This is the legitimation of the Eurasian project initiated by Putin. Rather than using Russian history to establish interests or evaluate perspectives within Russian society, Eurasia offered poetic utterances meant to create a lyrical unity from prior bloodshed. If Soviet terror murdered countless Russian Orthodox priests in the 1930s, all is well and good, because their spirits arose in the 1940s to bless the Red Army. The unification of two historical eras, a strategic alliance of reds and whites in the face of the liberal peril, this is the enormous worldview mission of true statesmen. Such an alliance is possible in the light of the mystical Russian victory of 1945, when the Red System had the prayerful support of all the saints killed in the years when the Church was persecuted, and the arms of the Red Victory became Holy Russian arms. The future Russian victory demands the union of Reds and Whites. It demands the creation of a state in which, as V.V. Putin said, Red Commissars can live together with White officers. The celebration of both the far left and the far right in the past elided Russia's present problem, the absence of a center, a political fulcrum, a succession principle that would allow power to shift from left to right or right to left while preserving the state. Since all political activity was ruled out as foreign, differences of opinion or acts of opposition had to be a result of the malignant designs of Europeans and Americans who resent Russia's immaculate innocence. The Russian messianic consciousness, grounded in the teaching of an earthly paradise, in an ideal existence, in the Orthodox dream of divine justice, all of this summons the negation of Russia at the level of worldview, the attacks on her faith, culture, and historical codes. A military invasion of Russia, the consequence of that intolerance and profound hostility. And so the theme of Russian weapons is a holy theme for Russia. Russian weapons protect not only cities, territories, the boundless richness of the earth. They protect the entire religious and cultural order of Russia, all of Russia's secular and holy shrines. These lines were published in the midst of a new armament program, which doubled Russia's annual weapons procurement budget between 2011 and 2013. The authors of the manifesto dreamed of a militarized totalitarian Russia that permanently mobilized the entire population and promised nothing but sacrifice. Russia does not need hasty political reform. It needs arms factories and altars. The loss of the historical moment after the destruction of the Red Empire, the strategic backwardness by comparison to the liberal West, demand from Russia a developmental leap. This leap involves a mobilization project, which would concentrate all the nation's resources upon the preservation of sovereignty and the defense of the people. After this initial salvo, further articles by members of the Izborsk Club elaborated this position. The liberal order that produced factuality, one member wrote, was the work of the world backstage, the core of which are the Zionist leaders. Other members of the Izborsk Club explained that Putin's Eurasian Union was the project of restoring Russia as a Eurasian empire. They presented the EU as an existential threat to Russia, since it enforced law and generated prosperity. Russian foreign policy should therefore support the extreme right within EU member states until the EU collapses, as Prohanov ecstatically anticipated, into a constellation of European fascist states. Ukraine, as one Izborsk Club expert wrote, is all ours, and eventually it will all come back to us. According to Dugin, the annexation of Ukrainian territory by Russia was the necessary condition of the Eurasian imperial project. For the Eurasianists of the Izborsk Club, facts were the enemy, Ukraine was the enemy, and facts about Ukraine were the supreme enemy. An intellectual task of the Izborsk Club was to produce the narratives that transported any such facts towards oblivion. Indeed, the mission of the Izborsk Club was to serve as a barrier to factuality. Izborsk was chosen as the name of the think tank because the town of Izborsk is the site of a historical Muscovite fortress that had resisted, as the club's website recalled, the Livonians, Poles, and Swedes. Now the invader was the liberal machine of factuality. One of Russia's long-range bombers, a Tu-95 built to drop atomic bombs on the United States, was renamed Izborsk in honor of the club. In case anyone failed to notice this sign of Kremlin backing, Prokhanov was invited to fly in the cockpit of the aircraft. In the years to come, this and other Tu-95s would regularly approach the airspace of the member states of the European Union, forcing them to activate their air defense systems and to escort the approaching bomber away. The Tu-95 Izborsk would be used to bomb Syria in 2015, creating refugees who would flee to Europe. Sergei Glazyov, advisor of Putin, reader of Gumilov, follower of Schmidt, member of Izborsk, linked Eurasian theory to practice. After Glazyov was fired from the Yeltsin administration for corruption in 1993, he got a helping hand from the American conspiracy theorist Lyndon LaRouche, who held similar views. In 1999, LaRouche published an English translation of Glazyov's tract Genocide, Russia and the New World Order, which posited that a cabal of Jewish neoliberals had deliberately destroyed Russia in the 1990s. Like other Russian fascists, Glazyov used terms associated with the Holocaust, for example, genocide, to suggest that Jews were the real perpetrators and Russians the real victims. He was elected to parliament as a communist in 1999 and then helped to found the radical nationalist party Rodina in 2003. This was not as much of a contradiction as it seemed. In Russia's managed democracy, Rodina was meant to draw votes away from the communist party towards a group trusted by Putin. Glazyov thought that a planned economy should serve the interests of the Russian nation, which in his view included Ukraine. We cannot forget the historical importance of Little Russia for us. We have never divided Russia and Ukraine in our minds. Russian foreign policy arose, Glazyov wrote, from the philosophy of Eurasianism. Following Schmidt, Glazyov maintained that states were obsolete. The Eurasian project was based on a fundamentally different spatial concept, Schmidt's idea of great spaces dominated by a great power. America must stay away, Glazyov decreed, since it was not part of the Eurasian great space. Since the EU was a bastion of state sovereignty, it must fall, and the citizens of its member states must be granted the fascist totality for which they long. Europeans, wrote Glazyov, have lost their sense of direction. They live in a mosaic, in a fragmented world with no shared relationships. Happily, Russian power could return them to what Glazyov regarded as reality. Glazyov did not discuss the preferences of the people who lived in the European Union. Did Europeans really need to discover firsthand the profundity of a Russian system where life expectancy in 2012 was 111th in the world, where the police could not be trusted, bribes and blackmail were the stuff of everyday life, and prison was a middle-class experience? In its distribution of wealth, Russia was the most unequal country in the world. The EU's far greater wealth was also far more evenly shared among its citizens. Glazyov helped his master maintain Russian kleptocracy by changing the subject from prosperity to values, to what Putin called civilization. Beginning in 2013, the principles of Eurasia guided the foreign policy of the Russian Federation. The official foreign policy concept for that year, published on February 18, under the signature of Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, with the special endorsement of President Vladimir Putin, included, amidst the boilerplate that remained unaltered from year to year, a series of changes corresponding to the ideas of Ilin, the Eurasianists, and their fascist traditions. The foreign policy concept repeated Putin's characterization of the future as roiling chaos and resource grabs. As states weakened, great spaces would reemerge. In such a world, there can be no oasis from global turbulence, so the EU is doomed. Law would give way to a contest of civilizations. Global competition demands, for the first time in contemporary history, a civilizational dimension. Russia was responsible not for the well-being of its citizens, but for the safety of undefined compatriots beyond its borders. Eurasia was a model of unification, open to the former republics of the Soviet Union and also to members of the current European Union. Its basis of cooperation was the preservation and extension of a common cultural and civilizational heritage. The concept made clear that the process of supplanting the EU with Eurasia was to begin immediately in 2013, at a time when Ukraine was in negotiations with the EU over the terms of an association agreement. According to the concept, if Ukraine wished to negotiate with the EU, it should accept Moscow as its intermediary. In Eurasia, Russian dominance was the order of things. In the long term, Eurasia would overcome the EU, leading to the creation of a unified humanitarian space from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. Lavrov later repeated this aspiration, citing Ilin as its source. Because the EU is a consensual organization, it was vulnerable to campaigns that raised emotions. Because it was composed of democratic states, it could be weakened by political parties advocating leaving the EU. Because the EU had never been meaningfully opposed, it never occurred to Europeans to ask whether debates on the internet were manipulated from outside with hostile intent. The Russian policy to destroy the EU took several corresponding forms. The recruitment of European leaders and parties to represent the Russian interest in European disintegration. The digital and televisual penetration of public discourse to sow distrust of the EU. The recruitment of extreme nationalists and fascists for public promotion of Eurasia, and the endorsement of separatism of all kinds. Putin befriended and supported European politicians who were willing to defend Russian interests. One was Gerhard Schröder, the retired German chancellor, who was in the employ of the Russian gas company Gazprom. A second was Miloš Zeman, elected president of the Czech Republic in 2013 after a campaign partly financed by the Russian oil company Lukoil, and re-elected in 2018 after a campaign financed by unknown sources. A third was Silvio Berlusconi, who shared vacations with Putin before and after leaving the office of Italian Prime Minister in 2011. In August 2013, Berlusconi was convicted of tax fraud and banned from public office until 2019. Putin suggested that Berlusconi's true problem was the persecution of heterosexuals. If he were gay, no one would ever lay a finger on him. Here Putin was enunciating the basic principle of his Eurasian civilization. When the subject is inequality, change it to sexuality. In 2018, Berlusconi began a political comeback. In the post-communist East European member states of the European Union, such as the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, and Poland, Russia financed and organized internet discussion outlets to cast doubt on the value of EU membership. These sites purported to provide news on various themes, but in every case suggested that the EU was decadent or unsafe. In the larger West European media markets, the international English, Spanish, German, and French language television network RT was more important. RT became the media home of European politicians who opposed the EU, such as Nigel Farage of the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, and Marine Le Pen of the Front National in France. Farage and Le Pen proposed a return to a non-existent past, when Europeans lived in nation-states without immigrants. They were eternally politicians, urging their fellow citizens to reconsider the 1930s as a golden age. Both Great Britain and France had been maritime empires that, as their colonies won independence, joined a European integration project. Never in modern history was either country a nation-state separated from the world. Thanks to the fable of the wise nation, their citizens generally did not understand their own history, and so did not appreciate the stakes of the debate about EU membership. Because Britain and France had no modern history as nation-states, an exit from the European Union would be a step into the unknown, rather than the comfortable homecoming promised by nationalism. It would mean joining Russia as the remnant state of a European empire beyond the reach of European integration. Thus, Farage and Le Pen were natural partners for a Russia whose approach to history was annihilation. In 2013, A preoccupation with gay sex brought together Russian and French politicians of eternity. That May, the French Parliament extended rights to same-sex couples. Marine Le Pen and her Front National then joined Russian activists to resist what they characterized as a global sodomite conspiracy. In June, Le Pen visited Russia and enthusiastically joined in Russia's new campaign for civilization. She advanced the Russian argument that gay rights were the sharp end of a global neoliberal conspiracy against innocent nations. In her words, homophilia is one of the elements of globalization, and Russia and France must together resist a new international empire infected by the virus of commercialization. That particular turn of phrase was a gesture to the belief, common among Russian nationalists, that Russians were too innocent to have contracted AIDS, and that therefore its presence in Russia was a result of biological warfare. Le Pen was happy to agree that Russia was the victim of a new Cold War that the EU is carrying out against Russia. Aymeric Chauprade, her advisor on foreign policy, promised his Russian audience that the Front National would destroy the European Union if it came to power. At that same moment, a few reliable Americans were also invited to defend Russia's new gender politics. RT interviewed Richard Spencer, the leading American white supremacist, on the question of American-Russian relations. As it happened, Spencer was married to Nina Kuprianova, Dugin's translator. Since Spencer admired Putin and believed that Russia was the sole white power in the world, it was not surprising that he was quick to blame the Obama administration for starting a Cold War over Russia's anti-sodomy campaign. 3 years later, Spencer would lead his followers in a modified Nazi chant, "Hail Trump, hail our people, hail victory." As it happened, Donald Trump was the second high-profile American to support Putin that summer, during the vulnerable moment when official Russia claimed for itself the role of protector of heterosexuality. Trump was in the midst of a long campaign to delegitimize the president of his own country by claiming, falsely, that Barack Obama had not been born in the United States. RT tried to make this notion plausible. Trump was eager, however, to flatter the president of another country. On June 18, 2013, Trump wondered in a tweet whether Putin will become my new best friend. Trump's contribution to global heterosexuality was to bring a beauty pageant to the Moscow suburbs, or rather to look on as Russians did so. In principle, he was the organizer. In fact, he was paid $20 million to oversee the work of his Russian colleagues. This was a pattern of relations between Russians and Trump that was by then long established. Trump was paid so that his name could assist Russians who knew something about money and power. Just a few weeks earlier, in April 2013, the FBI had arrested 29 men suspected of running two gambling rings inside Trump Tower. According to investigators, the operation was overseen by Alimjan Toktakunov, a Russian citizen who also ran a money laundering operation from a condo directly under Trump's own. As the FBI searched for him, Toktakunov attended the Miss Universe pageant and sat a few seats away from Trump. The United States attorney who had authorized the Trump Tower raid was Preet Bharara. Upon becoming president, Trump fired Bharara. The Russian property developer Aras Agalarov was Trump's partner in bringing the beauty pageant to Russia. Agalarov, whose father-in-law had been KGB chief in Soviet Azerbaijan, was an oligarch who specialized in relations with other oligarchs. He built shopping malls, gated communities, and, later, two soccer stadiums for Putin to accommodate the 2018 World Cup. He did the work for the Miss Universe pageant. It was hosted on his property, his wife was a judge, his son sang. Trump said that during the pageant he was with all the top people. Be that as it may, his relationship with the Agalarov family continued. Trump sent Agalarov's son, the pop star Amin, a video greeting on his birthday. The Agalarov family offered its help when Trump decided to run for president. Among the many instances of contact between the Trump campaign and prominent Russians was a meeting in Trump Tower in June 2016, in which a Russian lawyer, briefed by the chief prosecutor of the Russian Federation, offered the Trump campaign materials about Hillary Clinton. It was the Agalarov family that initiated the contact and brought the group together. When Donald Trump Jr. heard of the possibility of cooperating with a foreign power against the Clinton campaign, he replied, "I love it." The love began that summer of 2013. Agalarov was awarded the Order of Honor from Putin right before the Miss Universe pageant was held. On the day when Trump wondered if Putin would become his new best friend, Le Pen was touring the Russian parliament. In the years to come, Le Pen and Trump would each support the other's aspirations to the presidency. Their 2013 visits to Moscow, superficially about homosexuality and heterosexuality, deepened political and financial debts to Russia. In late 2013 and early 2014, both Marine Le Pen and her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, the founder of her party, announced that the Front National was funded by Russia. A mediator in the financial transactions between Russia and the Front National was Aymeric Chauprade, who was himself allowed to borrow 400,000 euros as a reward for arranging a loan from a Russian bank to Jean-Marie Le Pen. Although the Front National was pleased to join the Kremlin in its anti-sodomy campaign, its major issue at home in France was immigration and Islam. Accordingly, actors in Russia tried to drive French voters towards the Front National by spreading fear of Islamist terrorism. In April 2015, Russian hackers took over the transmission of a French television station, pretended to be the Islamist terrorist group ISIS, and then broadcast a message designed to frighten French voters. That November, when 130 people were killed and 368 injured in a real terrorist attack in Paris, Prohanov predicted that terrorism would drive Europe towards fascism and Russia. In the 2017 French presidential campaign, Marine Le Pen praised her patron, Putin. She finished second in the first round of elections that April, defeating every candidate from France's traditional parties. Her opponent in the second round was Emmanuel Macron, whom Russian propaganda insinuated was the gay candidate of the gay lobby. In the second round, Le Pen received 34% of the ballots. Though she lost to Macron, she did better than any other far-right candidate in the history of post-war France. To support the Front National was to attack the European Union. France was, after Germany, the EU's most important member, and Le Pen, the EU's most powerful critic. In 2013, Russia's financing of the Front National seemed much more likely to alter the future of the EU than its support of Nigel Farage and Brexit, his project to remove Britain from the European Union. Farage, like Le Pen, Spencer, and Trump, supported Putin during his turn to Eurasia. On July 8, 2013, Farage claimed on RT that the European project is actually beginning to die. The first order of business for Russian foreign policy in the United Kingdom was actually Scottish separatism. The Scottish National Party was urging Scots to vote for independence in a referendum. In the weeks before it was held on September 18, 2014, Russian media falsely suggested that Scotland would lose its health service and its football team if it remained in Great Britain. After a majority of Scottish voters elected to remain in the United Kingdom, videos appeared on the internet that seemed to cast doubt about the validity of the vote. One of them showed actual vote rigging in Russia, presented as Scotland. These videos were then promoted over Twitter by accounts based in Russia. Then, a Russian official proclaimed that the result was a total falsification. Although no actual irregularities were reported, roughly a third of Scottish voters gained the impression that something fraudulent had taken place. It would have been a victory for Russia had Scotland left the United Kingdom, but it was also a victory for Russia if the inhabitants of the United Kingdom came to distrust their institutions. After the Conservative Party won the May 2015 general election in the United Kingdom, RT published an opinion piece on its website claiming that the British electoral system was rigged. Although Britain's Conservative Party could form a government by itself after those elections, it was divided on the issue of Britain's membership in the European Union. In order to end the intra-party dispute, Prime Minister David Cameron agreed to a non-binding national referendum on the question. This was extremely good news for Moscow, although it was not entirely a surprise. Russia had been preparing for such a possibility for some time. In 2012, Russian intelligence had founded, in Britain, a front organization called the Conservative Friends of Russia. One of its founding members, the British lobbyist Matthew Elliott, served as the chief executive of Vote Leave, the official organization making the case for a British exit from the EU. Nigel Farage, leader of the political party founded on the program of leaving the EU, kept appearing on RT and expressed his admiration for Putin. One of his senior staffers took part in a Russian smear campaign against the president of Lithuania, who had criticized Putin. All of the major Russian television channels, including RT, supported the vote to leave the EU in the weeks before the June 23, 2016 poll. A persuasion campaign on the internet, although unnoticed at the time, was probably more important. Russian internet trolls, live people who participated in exchanges with British voters, and Russian Twitter bots, computer programs that sent out millions of targeted messages, engaged massively on behalf of the Leave campaign. 419 Twitter accounts that posted on Brexit were localized to Russia's Internet Research Agency. Later, every single one of them would also post on behalf of Donald Trump's presidential campaign. About a third of the discussion of Brexit on Twitter was generated by bots, and more than 90% of the bots tweeting political material were not located in the United Kingdom. Britons who considered their choices had no idea at the time that they were reading material disseminated by bots, nor that the bots were part of a Russian foreign policy to weaken their country. The margin of the vote was 52% for leaving and 48% for staying. This time, no Russian voice questioned the result, presumably since the voting had gone the way Moscow had wished. Brexit was a triumph for Russian foreign policy, and a sign that a cyber campaign directed from Moscow could change reality. For some time, Russian politicians have been urging Britain to separate from the European Union. In 2015, Konstantin Kosachev, the chairman of the International Affairs Committee of the Duma, had instructed the British about the myth that the European Union was infallible and invulnerable. After the referendum, Vladimir Putin provided a soothing argument in favor of the disintegration of the EU, that the British had been exploited by others. In fact, many of the districts of Great Britain most heavily subsidized by the EU voted to leave it. Putin gently supported the misunderstandings and prejudices that led to things falling apart. No one wants to feed and subsidize weaker economies, support other states, whole peoples. It is an obvious fact. Moscow had weaponized the fable of the wise nation. In fact, Britain had never been a state that had decided to support others, but a collapsing empire whose statehood was rescued by European integration. Pervy Kanal, the most important Russian television station, soothingly confirmed the myth that Britain could go it alone because it had always done so. For this nation, it is important that none of its alliances or commitments are binding. Under the mistaken impression that they had a history as a nation-state, the British, the English mainly, voted themselves into an abyss where Russia awaited. Russia's support of Austrian enemies of the EU was ostentatious. Like Great Britain and France, Austria was the metropole of an old European empire that had joined the integration process. Austria had been the heart of the Habsburg monarchy, and then during the 1920s and 1930s a failed nation-state, then for 7 years a part of Nazi Germany. Some of the leaders of its Freiheitliche Party were connected by family, or ideology, or both, to Nazi ideology. This was the case with Johann Gudinus, who studied in Moscow and spoke Russian. During the 2016 Austrian presidential campaign, the Freiheitliche were negotiating a cooperation agreement with Putin's party in Russia, apparently in the expectation that their candidate Norbert Hofer would win. He almost did. In April, he won the first round of the election. He narrowly lost the second round, which was then repeated after a claim of electoral violations. In December 2016, Hofer lost the second round again. He did take 46% of the total vote, the most a Freiheitliche candidate had received in an Austrian national election. As in France, Russia's candidate did not win, but performed far better than would have been expected when Russia's campaign to destroy the European Union began. In December 2016, Freiheitliche leaders flew to Moscow to sign the cooperation agreement they had negotiated with Putin's political party. In October 2017, the Freiheitliche won 26% in Austria's parliamentary elections and then joined a coalition government that December. A far-right party in open partnership with Moscow was helping to govern an EU member. Integration or empire? Would Russia's new Eurasian imperialism destroy the EU? Or would European integration reach territory that had been part of the Soviet Union in 1922? That was the European question of 2013. As Moscow persistently sought that year to destroy the EU, Kiev was finalizing an association agreement with it. The trade pact was popular in Ukraine. Oligarchs wanted access to EU markets. Owners of small businesses wanted the rule of law to compete with those oligarchs. Students and younger people wanted the European future. Although President Viktor Yanukovych tried hard not to see it, he was facing a choice. If Ukraine signed an association agreement with the EU, it would not be able to join Putin's Eurasia. The Eurasianists themselves took a clear position. Dugin had long urged the destruction of Ukraine. Prokhanov had suggested in July 2013 that Yanukovych might have to be removed. In September 2013, Glazyov said that Russia could invade Ukrainian territory if Ukraine did not join Eurasia. In November 2013, Yanukovych failed everyone. He did not sign the completed association agreement, nor did he bring Ukraine into Eurasia. In February 2014, Russia invaded Ukraine. A Russian politics of eternity was engaging a European politics of inevitability. Europeans had little idea what to do. The EU had never been resisted, let alone combated. Few realized that an attack on integration was also an attack on their own fragile states. Moscow was continuing the campaign against the EU on what it believed would be the yielding territory of Ukraine. Because they failed to understand the stakes of the conflict in Ukraine, Europeans proved to be more vulnerable to Russian attack than Ukrainians. Because Ukrainians were aware that their own state was fragile, many had no trouble seeing the EU as a precondition for a future with law and prosperity. They saw Russia's intervention as cause for a patriotic revolution, since they understood EU membership as a stage in the construction of a Ukrainian state. Other Europeans had forgotten this connection, and so experienced the political problem posed by Russia's war in Ukraine as cultural difference. Europeans proved vulnerable to soporific Russian propaganda, suggesting that Ukraine's problems showed its distance from the European mainstream. The Russian politics of eternity easily found the blindness at the center of the European politics of inevitability. Russians had only to say, as they would in 2014 and 2015, that Ukrainians were not a wise nation, since they had not learned the lessons of the Second World War. Europeans who nodded sagely and did nothing reinforced a basic misunderstanding of their own history and placed the sovereignty of their own states in jeopardy. The only escape from the alternatives of inevitability and eternity was history, understanding it or making it. Ukrainians, seeing their situation for what it was, had to do something new. Chapter 4. Novelty or Eternity, 2014. Beginning, before it becomes a historical event, is the supreme capacity of man. Politically, it is identical with man's freedom. Hannah Arendt, 1951. The Russian politics of eternity reached back 1,000 years to find a mythical moment of innocence. Vladimir Putin claimed that his millennial vision of the baptism of Volodymyr Valdemar of Kiev made Russia and Ukraine a single people. While visiting Kiev in July 2013, Putin read souls and spoke of God's geopolitics. Our spiritual unity began with the baptism of Holy Rus 1,025 years ago. Since then, much has happened in the lives of our peoples, but our spiritual unity is so strong that it is not subject to any action by any authority, neither government authorities nor, I would even go so far as to say, church authorities. Because regardless of any existing authority over the people, there can be none that is stronger than the authority of the Lord. Nothing can be stronger than that. And this is the most solid foundation for our unity in the souls of our people. In September 2013 at Valdai, his official presidential summit on foreign policy, Putin expressed his vision in secular terms. He cited Ilin's organic model of Russian statehood, in which Ukraine was an inseparable organ of the virginal Russian body. "We have common traditions, a common mentality, a common history, and a common culture," said Putin. "We have very similar languages. In that respect, I want to repeat again, we are one people. The association agreement between the EU and Ukraine